Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with two cast members from Soft Power, David Henry Huang and Janine Tesori's new musical play at The Current. Fantastic show. It's running through July 8th, and I'll be talking with Austin Koo and Maria Cristina Oliveris. From Ferocious Lotus, the Bay Area's premier Asian-American theater company, I'll talk with director Lily Tung Crystal to discuss 2 Mile Hollow, a new play by award-winning playwright Leah Nanako Winkler. Mei Liang, the Ferocious Lotus literary manager, will also be with us, as well as a cast member, Rinabeth Apostle. Also stopping by, conductor, trumpeter Jason Park, and member of the board, Bruce De Benedictis, to talk about the Friends of Oakland Municipal Band, one of the oldest organizations in the country that has been presenting free concerts at the Band Shell in Lakeside Park since 1912. Regular contributor Peter Robinson will also have some museum suggestions for your summer months. Stay with us. Well, it's being called the most important musical since Hamilton, and it's at the Current Theater here in San Francisco through July 8th. Most superlatives don't really suffice to describe it. Remarkable, inspiring, hilarious, moving. This contemporary comedy is a first collaboration between two of America's great theater artists, Tony Award winners David Henry Huang and Janine Tesori, who wrote Fun Home, which was also at the Current recently. And it sort of rewinds our recent political history, plays it back through a Chinese lens, a future beloved East meets West musical that's part King and I and part Capital Steps, I'd say. And I'm pleased to be joined by two of the actors in the production, Austin Koo, who plays Bobby Bob. His credits include David Henry Huang's Chinglish and for an international and Broadway tour. Off-Broadway credits abound, as well as do regional theater credits. He's also been seen on TV in Shades of Blue, Homeland, Sneaky Pete, and much more. He's also been working with the Boston Conservatory and the Upright Citizens Brigade, where he got some of his training. Austin, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. Joined by your castmate, Maria Cristina Oliveris, who plays Betsy. She was last seen in Amelie, which she subsequently did on Broadway, where she's also been seen in Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson, as well as other shows on and off Broadway. Regional credits include our own, in addition to all around the country, Berkeley Rep, some work at Berkeley Rep, and she's currently playing Betsy in Soft Power. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much, David. Good to be here.
Of course. Gosh, how do we describe this music? How do you describe this musical to friends? Give us a synopsis, would you?
Well, we definitely at least pitch it as a play with a musical. That's kind of the term that we've coined. And really, I say it is a rendering of America around 2016 election, 100 years from now, via a Chinese musical, a Chinese theater troupe 100 years from now, kind of reconceiving what this moment in time is for us.
Yeah, I think the sort of tagline that you opened the show with is pretty apt, that it's a political fantasia that takes mm-hmm. sort of our recent political situation and views it from a Chinese perspective in the future, or an imagined Chinese perspective in the future, because it's all imagined through the eyes of a dream that David Henry Huang has.
So let's dissect a little bit what the meaning of soft power is for people that aren't familiar. Want to tackle that?
It's based on a term that Joseph Nye coined in the 80s relating to a nation's ability to kind of influence the world not through guns and military control, but through arts and culture. As opposed to hard power and militaristic kind of regime.
Mm-hmm. And so the soft power that has been this country's assets are somewhat envied by other countries,
mm-hmm.
particularly Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, I think our Hollywood culture and, you know, social media, stars and celebrity, all of that is sort of the gold standard around the world right now. And that's something that other countries, especially China, as they're increasing in their financial and other kinds of power, are trying to emulate.
Mm-hmm. So, Austin, tell us about your character, Bobby Bob.
Oh, my gosh. So Bobby Bob is described in the play as the good-hearted American friend, because the play centers around these two, the Chinese and the Chinese-American characters. And then when they come to America in this sort of fever dream, they meet a bunch of American vis-a-vis sort of white Caucasian people. And I actually play a Caucasian character who befriends the main characters.
And tell us more of your interactions with these characters.
Oh, so, I mean, without giving too much away, I sort of become their tour guide and as they explore America, which is in sort of a reversal, like you were saying, it's sort of King and I meets other things. So it's a reversal of King and I, where DHH, David Henry Hwang, has sort of taken the trope of the white savior, which we see in a lot of movies and things, and The King and I, where a white character goes to a foreign, dangerous country and sort of like becomes savior of the country. And so in this show, it's a Chinese person that comes to America, and which is so dangerous and everything, and then, you know, meets a leader of the country and befriends her and maybe falls in love with her and helps save our country. And so his way in is this good-hearted American kid who he meets. So I sort of play that role.
Nice. It's really fun to see. Maria Cristina, what is your role of Betsy?
Betsy, I play Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, not to be confused with Hillary Rodham Clinton. There is a character called Hillary Clinton, which Elise beautifully, brilliantly portrays. But it's the imagined Hillary from the Chinese theater troupe 100 years from now, so keep that in mind. And I love playing the campaign manager. I actually campaigned for the real Hillary Clinton back in October. So,
those were the days.
Yes, indeed. So it's nice to be fighting for that again in this particular moment in time, mm-hmm. with hope.
Mm-hmm. So the comedic element is just so strong in this. Austin, you're familiar with David Henry Hwang's work. Is it kind of a continuation, or do you see some common elements from Chinglish in his writing coming forth in Soft Power?
I do. I think the themes he deals with in all of his shows are, you know, East meets West. Mm. Usually our predominant theme in his shows, as well as like personal identity as he's a Chinese American. I think he's maybe third generation Chinese American, and sort of the struggle of identity between those two cultures, both within a single person as in the character GHH in the show, which is semi-autobiographical, has an identity crisis about being Chinese and also American in this future reverse musical, but then also the greater show at large deals a lot with East versus West culture.
Mm-hmm. So it's really part David's dream come forth on the stage, but there's also some real life things that happen to him that he incorporates into the play. Can you share with us some of that?
Well, the inciting incident that kind of prompts this fever dream, unfortunately, David was jumped, attacked back in 2015, mm-hmm. mugged, and stabbed.
And I mean, not really mugged because they didn't steal
anything. Oh, right.
Anything.
They didn't take anything, which was so, bizarre. Just a, however, I'm hate crime. I'm not sure how that kind of panned out. But he did. He ran home to his family, and exactly how there's a monologue that Francis Ju, who portrays him in the show, talks about that incident. So that's definitely one. Obviously, the real life political incidents that it's inspired by. The election and the fallout there. Other of the personal experiences, I'm trying to think with the DHH.
I think that's the main one.
The main one is that
we're referencing is the attack
stabbing,
where he was just randomly stabbed in the neck from behind by a person who stabbed him and then ran away.
Huh.
Yeah.
in Brooklyn at like 9 p.m.
That's bizarre, yeah. And you incorporated it quite interestingly into the play. Mm-hmm. So tell us about how this came to life. What was it like working on this incredible production?
Wow, I mean, it was really cool to be in something. I mean, you were in other, have been in other big productions from the beginning. I've been in this production from the beginning over 2 years ago when, you know, it was an idea that was formulating in DHH's head after the stabbing. And it came about from a commission of Center Theater Group in Los Angeles for their 50th anniversary season. And David saw the Broadway revival of The King and I and thought about, oh, this is a great show. From what he said, you know, I'm not sure that I agree with all the themes in it, with, like, you know, the
imposition of Western culture,
right,
into
the
East,
the white governess who comes to nanny the king's kids and then somehow becomes the love interest and the advisor
savior,
to the king,
the savior
of the whole country of Siam, Thailand. But boy, this musical is beautiful. And it fit into the things that he likes to write about. And so he had this concept of, well, what if we had the reverse of that, of a Chinese character who comes into Wild West America and has all those same experiences? What would that inverse look like? Mm-hmm. And then that was subsequently altered a little bit by the stabbing that happened to him, and also by the actual election that happened, that sort of threw a wrench into his original plan just to have a straightforward King and I reversal.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think his initial, as far as my understanding, was about gun control, and then that shifted after the election as well. You know, and what I love, and I haven't been a part of it for as long as Austin has, but what I've loved about doing the piece, particularly at this moment, is it speaks on so many different issues depending on your filter, what you bring to the theater, whether your politics, your color, your ideals, what happens in the world in the moment daily. I mean, depending on what happens, you know, today will affect the audience tonight. And this show engages people in a conversation that makes it so timely, and not only timely, but timely in a way that really is engaging people to think about who they are and what they are and how we're kind of existing as Americans, which I just think is so important to me as an artist, that we are engaging and questioning and provoking on some level.
Mm. And you can't take your eye off the stage. It's really a compelling production to see.
Thank you.
So it runs only through the July 8th here at The Current. Does it have legs, so to speak? Do we know if it's going to be elsewhere?
We're hopeful. There's nothing, you know, official by any means. We know that we're here gloriously through July 8th at The Curran, and hopefully thereafter. But
response has been great, and mm-hmm. I know rumors abound.
Yeah, of course.
As always.
Yeah. Well, Austin, what else is on your plate then after July 8th? It's always a dangerous question for an actor, I know.
I think, you know, there's always things in the works. So after July 8th, I go back to New York. I know Maria Christina has some things lined up. I've got some things in the works that I can't necessarily talk about, but some TV work mm-hmm. that is exciting and possibly coming up.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to reading about it at austin-koo.com.
Oh, thanks.
And how about you, Maria?
I'm heading back to New York as well. I start a new play at the Yale Rep in August, so I have a little bit of downtime. I'm going to head to Puerto Rico to volunteer for hurricane relief. The next play is actually contextualized within a hurricane, so and then just a couple of cabarets, Studio 54, 54 Below, and Joe's Pub when I get back, yeah, just getting back into the swing of things. A couple of TV things, which I can't say either. But
I understand you're keeping up on your Instagram account more than your website. So which would you like to offer for people?
But my handle on Instagram is at mcoliveras, and I will update my website, mariachristinaoliveras.com.
And information about the Curran's production of Soft Power is at sfcurran.com, just through July 8th. Really make an attempt to see it, especially if you haven't been to The Curran. It's a spectacular renovation they've done. It's a beautiful place to catch some extraordinary theater. David Henry Hwang, amazing musical, collaborating with Janine Tesori, who wrote Fun Home. Well worth your time. sfcurran.com. We're going to go out with the tune Democracy. Tell us who sings that and who's...
This is the glorious ensemble. It's every single one of us. And just listen to the lyrics well. Right, is this the one?
I think it's
the finale?
The solo one.
Oh, then it's Elise.
Oh, I'm sorry. So then it's Elise Allen Lewis who...
Because we sing it twice in the
show. Yes, we do sing it twice. And she plays the character of Hillary
Clinton. Elise Allen Lewis.
Elise Allen Lewis, yep. Hillary Clinton character. Yeah.
Singing about her love of democracy, yeah. Which is a running theme through the show.
And it's kind of love-hate association with the Ballad of Democracy, let's call it.
Exactly.
And I've done shows with her since 2015, so it's actually a deeply wonderful personal journey with her to play her campaign manager and supporter, and she's fantastic.
Fantastic.
Here she is.
So many times it's left me battered and bruised, disillusioned, in pain, feeling I've been used. I swear I'll give it up before it downright kills me. Then it comes back again with promises that thrill me, and I forget what I really should know, and I forget that it's just a big, big show. And I dream, oh, I dream of all. In democracy, ooh, democracy, democracy.
Democracy, sung by the Hillary Clinton character Elise Allen Lewis in the Curran's production, a presentation of Soft Power by David Henry Hwang. sfcurran.com for more information. Good afternoon once again. I'm David Latulippe. You're listening to Open Air on KALW San Francisco. You'll have some museum suggestions from my regular contributor Peter Robinson coming up. And you'll also hear about 2 Mile Hollow, a comedy about a wealthy, dysfunctional Caucasian family portrayed by an entirely Asian cast. It's being presented by Ferocious Lotus. And next, well, since 1912, the Oakland Municipal Band has been presenting free concerts at Lakeside Park in the heart of Oakland, California. It's one of the oldest musical organizations in the country. These concerts bring citizens of all ages and backgrounds together for music, picnicking, and socializing. And this 35-piece band will be presenting concerts usually on Sundays, but since July 4th is a Wednesday this year, they have a concert on July 4th and have concerts through August 5th. I'm joined by one of the players in the band. Jason Park has been a collaborator with me on a few occasions on some organizations. He's quite a versatile musician with credits as a solo performer, orchestral and chamber musician, as well as a conductor, trumpeter, and musical director here in San Francisco as well as Hawaii. Some regional credits also include the San Francisco Playhouse, Berkeley Playhouse, Broadway by the Bay, and doing clinics for high school bands and orchestras in this area as well as Hawaii. Jason, a pleasure to welcome you to our waves.
Thank you for having me.
And he's joined by one of the members of the chairman of the board of the Oakland Municipal Band, Dr. Bruce DeBenedictis, who was born in Oakland, spent some time in New Jersey growing up. He's a UC Berkeley graduate where he studied math and German and cultivated an interest in piano tuning, eventually being piano tuner for several organizations, including the SF Jazz Festival for their first 30 years. He happened upon the Oakland Municipal Band in Lakeshore Park one afternoon, and now, many years later, chairman of the board of the Friends of the Oakland Municipal Band. Welcome to you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Happy to have you both. I've played in this band. It's a fun band. It's a great venue. Tell us a little bit about the history of it, if we could. Bruce.
Well, the band started in 1912, and the bandstand was built for it in 1920. And for many years, it was supported by the city, but of course, Proposition 13 took care of that. And so now we're down to 5 concerts per year. We almost lost the bandstand after the earthquake in 1989. but it was decided that it was worth preserving, and it has been retrofitted. More lately, we have a wheelchair ramp to the bandstand. For many years, the band had been administered by Ann Waddell, sort of the first lady of Parks and Recreation in Oakland, and she did a lot for many organizations associated with Parks and Recreation. And I came along afterwards. We met her at the Mother of the Year ceremony in 2002 when my wife was Mother of the Year. And we were walking in the park, and we heard the band. We went over and watched. There was a friend I knew there helping her. And I took over the production of the band, setting up and that sort of thing. And when Ann passed away, sadly, a year ago in January, I was the next in line to take over and have been doing it ever since. And it's been a struggle.
Well, I imagine financing is always the main struggle to keep things moving on this.
Financing is a struggle. I can afford to finance it to make up the difference in what we get in donations for a few years, but sustainability is actually more of an issue. Mm-hmm. I'm older than Ann was when she took over the band, and I'm looking actively for people who would be interested in coming and learning some arts administration. It's a good organization for doing that because it's small and enough that you can handle everything, but we're dealing with a whole bunch of things. We're dealing with the city. We're dealing with the Musicians Union.
Right.
This is a professional band.
We should
mention
that, yes.
And we're dealing with the public in various ways. And I'm trying to broaden it in as many ways as we can. But,
sure.
There are too few of us, and it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm. Jason, this is one of many organizations that you're involved in. When did you first get involved with the Oakland Municipal Band?
I think it's been about 10 years now that I've been playing trumpet with the group, and so much fun. I absolutely love it. And this year, I was asked to guest conduct a couple of the concerts. I'll be conducting on July 4th and July 22nd. And that's because our former music director, Troy Davis, has decided to move on to some bigger projects that he's doing. And he recently became the music director for West Valley College. And we wish him all the best on that.
A full plate there, no doubt.
Yes.
And now you have the good fortune of having contracted Dr. Andy Collinsworth.
Yes. What an amazing person and musician, and I think the band's going to be very fortunate to have him stepping into the role. He's extremely qualified and will bring such a great energy to the season, I think. Mm-hmm. So,
how are the programs determined?
Well, it's left to the conductors, and so I had to put together programs for the 4th of July and July 22nd, whereas Andy pulled his own music. He is sticking to a very traditional sort of concert repertoire. The 4th, obviously, is going to be full of patriotic music. And for July 22nd, I've decided to do more of a symphonic feature. So a lot of symphonic pieces, some things that you would normally hear done by symphony orchestras, which were arranged for concert band. I'm very excited. The July 4th concert was a bit of a challenge because of the current political state, and people are quite sensitive these days, I think, to certain
pieces. I think we need to commission a Russian composer to do something a la Copeland Portrait, but call it the Tweets of Donald Trump. Has to be a Russian composer.
Yes, right? Indeed.
This is what he said. This is really what our president said. Tweeted. This is what he tweeted. Let's hear some music, and then we'll talk some more about
sure.
the band.
What do you got for us? One of maybe I should leave this as a surprise, but I was going to play something from a piece we all know, America the Beautiful, which was inspired by a Facebook video that I saw of a Jesse Norman interview, how she was talking about how the current national anthem is unsingable, and she thinks that it should be America the Beautiful, which is a much more beautiful song.
I concur.
A little easier to sing by a wider audience. And it doesn't talk about war. It talks about the beauty of the land. And so I'm going to save that for the concert, so you'll have to come and see that. But one clip that I did want to play, my very first concert experience, conducting experience, was in high school in my senior year. And I picked the very ambitious, difficult piece, the William Tell Overture. And the main reason is truly because of the flute and English horn duet, which I think we all know. I'll just play a little bit of that.
Sure. Very familiar music, of course, from the William Tell Overture, music of Rossini, featured on the July 4th program.
Yes, indeed.
Great.
And I'm especially excited to hear our principal flutist, Gail Edwards, and,
oh, great.
And our principal oboist, Brenda Schumann-Post, attacking that. And, of course, I could get to it, but the very famous trumpet gallop section, which is so much fun to play. but we'll be doing an arrangement of the entire work on July 4th, and it's sort of to celebrate. This is my very first piece that I've ever conducted, and it's something that's very special to me. So,
very nice. Yeah. Bruce, tell us about, I guess people can go to oaklandmunicipalband.org to learn about the programs as well as how to support the group.
Yes, yes. One of the things that I had to do this past year, besides finding a new music director, is getting a new host for the website. And one of my friends has offered to do that for me. We have a beautiful new website. And we can take credit cards for donations.
There you go.
Very important.
Of course.
But it's all part of moving forward with the band. I hope this will be a new beginning for the band, and we can really do things in the future that will help. Part of what I've tried to do, the only place where I am making any demands on the on the program is to have music from other organizations who we can promote. So for the Star Spangled Banner and America the Beautiful, we're having Eliza O'Malley from the Berklee Chamber Opera, who will be singing along with the band. And then at the July 4th concert, we'll also be having Oklahoma, which is being done at Woodminster.
Oh, nice.
Right afterwards.
They're also doing that up at Oregon Shakespeare Festival with a same-sex couple as the leads.
Oh, I believe it's the 75th anniversary of the
It is indeed, Rodgers and Hammerstein's
musical.
Oklahoma. Well, I wish you every success, Dr. Benedictus, with growing the group and sustaining the group.
I'm afraid I'm not a doctor.
But you could play one on TV, Albert. Jason, thanks for coming in. Let's hear a little bit more music from the Oakland Municipal Band, and we will encourage you to see you on the podium on July 4th and July 22nd. And then Andy Collinsworth will take the helm for the remaining Sunday concerts on Sunday, July 15th, the 29th, and August 5th. Again, oaklandmunicipalband.org for more information. Thanks for coming in, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, and the band always goes out with Stars and Stripes Forever. So this is the band playing the Stars and Stripes Forever.
Let's get into the mood for the 4th. Here we go. Thank you. And the beautiful piccolo solo from Stars and Stripes Forever, which will be part of the July 4th celebration of the Oakland Municipal Band, performing on July 4th, a Wednesday. Normally they're on Sundays in July through August 5th. More information at oaklandmunicipalband.org. Well, more of an East meets West sort of theater experience is heading your way at Ferocious Lotus. It's the world premiere of 2 Mile Hollow by Leah Nanako Winkler. In 2 Mile Hollow, we meet the Donnellys, a famous dysfunctional Caucasian family who are so obsessed with their own privilege that they don't know what to make of their son's ethnically ambiguous assistant who comes to visit. Through the weekend, hilarity ensues as siblings argue over women and motorcycles, a mother creates self-loathing in her gluten-intolerant daughter, and complicated and unique secrets are unveiled over white wine. 2 Mile Hollow's artistic director is Lily Tung Crystal. She joins me in studio. She made her directorial debut in 2015, helming David Henry Hwang's Chinglish at Palo Alto Players, another connection to today's show, for which she was nominated for a Theater Bay Area Award for Outstanding Direction. She's directed at Those Women Productions and has been seen on stage and screen in several productions, and it's a pleasure to welcome Lily to our open airwaves. Hi, Lily.
Thank you, David. Hi.
Hi. She's joined by the 3 Mile Hollow Ferocious Lotus literary manager, Mei Liang, who is an emerging director, theater artist, and literary manager for the group. She's most recently worked with California Shakespeare Theater as the social impact consultant and assistant dramaturge for Shakespeare's As You Like It. She's also a UC graduate, UC Berkeley graduate with degrees in theater and performance studies, as well as integrative biology, currently working at the San Francisco Film Commission. May, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
And one of the actors joins us in studio as well from the production, Rinabeth Apostol. She's working with some of her favorite artists, and recent appearances have been all over the country in regional theater projects such as in Louisville, as well as here at ACT, at San Jose Rep, Arizona Theater Company, and has worked with Berkeley Rep, Playwrights Foundation, as well as Crowded Fire and The Groundlings. She's not only playing a role in the production as Charlotte, she's also a fight captain and choreographer. Rinabeth, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having us over.
Sure. Well, let's talk a bit about the premise of the show and how... Well, let's talk firstly about Ferocious Lotus. I love the title. I couldn't say it 3 times fast if you paid me. But tell us the mission behind Ferocious Lotus.
So our mission is to redefine Asian American narratives and American narratives in theater, more than diversity, because I think diversity is a term that's often thrown around, is we promote reality, the reality that our neighborhoods comprise people of all different races, genders, cultures, and backgrounds, and we believe that theater should represent that reality. And we work primarily with professional Asian American theater artists, and all of our work, I think a lot of people think about an Asian American theater company and they think it's really Asian-y, for lack of a better word, really Asian-y work, but our work really defies convention, and it sort of pushes the envelope in terms of theatrical innovation and thematic themes of what it means to be American and what it means to be Asian American today.
So the playwright Leah Nanako is kind of turning things around in this play. And how did you first come across Leah's work?
Well, a few years ago, we produced a reading series called The Ferocious New Play Readings. And we featured Asian American women playwrights directed by Asian American directors. And Mei helped curate that. She's a literary manager. She's also an incredibly talented director, too. Leah's agent brought this play to us, and we read it at that festival, and it was an audience hit because it's hilarious. And it at that time, it was the 2016 election. And so I think we had our reading within a few days of the election, maybe 2 days later. Yeah. And I think a lot of us felt really just bowled over. I mean, you know, kind of like a truck ran over us in terms of what it meant for equity, inclusion, and diversity in the U.S. And her play really questions American identity and turns on its head like dominant narratives that are in the American canon and what we as people of color, the narratives that we hear in the theater. And so it was an audience favorite, and it's hilarious. I mean, it's laugh out loud funny. If you come to see it, which I hope you do, it's 2 hours of, I mean, laughing. It's the audience literally lasts for 2 hours. So it was an audience favorite, and it's not only funny, but it has a really powerful message about you know, whose voices are heard in America and whose stories are told.
Mm-hmm. That's Lily Tung Crystal directing Ferocious Lotus production of the world premiere of 2 Mile Hollow by Leah Nanako Winkler. Also joined by the literary manager of Ferocious Lotus, Mei Liang. So I imagine your work is a lot of just trying to discover appropriate works for Ferocious Lotus.
Yes, absolutely. So as Lily mentioned, a few years ago we put on a reading, and the reading specifically was to not just raise the voices of Asian American artists, but female Asian American artists. So that whole the whole reading series was all Asian American female women, directed by Asian American female women. So, and not in Asian American in East Asia, but also South Asia. And it was a really diverse conglomeration of stories and characters and voices. And this one in particular, again, is a favorite. But for me as a literary manager and also a director, I think it was also interesting to look at having Asian Americans as a model minority portray Caucasian people. And during that time for me, I thought it was a very interesting political statement as well, in what that means and how do we redefine not just American life and American stories, but Asian American stories. What do we see? What are the critiques? And how do we fit into that narrative? So that was very interesting for this.
Interesting. And so what's down the road for Ferocious Lotus in terms of what you're offering to the management and the board to say, well, you should consider this.
We have to talk about that for sure. But something that has been kind of ruminating a little bit is we're actually wanting to look a bit more at the classics. How do we redefine some of the classics through our eyes? And so we've been looking at possibly doing a redoing of a Shakespeare play put on by us and casting, again, it's more of a casting thing, but casting people of color within these roles, and what does that mean? What is that? How does that change the story when you cast different people in these classic stories?
And Rinabeth Apostle, you are one of the hats you're wearing is as Charlotte. Tell us about that character first.
Well, the character of Charlotte happens to be the only non-Caucasian character in the play. I know that you had discussions earlier in regards to David Henry Wong's play Soft Power and how he becomes the Chinese savior. Well, Charlotte is unofficially what's written in the script, ethnically ambiguous savior that comes into the Donnelly home, turning the house upside down, whether it's discussions about relationships or forcing the matriarch of the family to take a hard look at herself and who she is as a person, and hopefully teaching the family and the audience cultural humility. And it's been a blast. Lily mentioned that the audience is laughing, and it takes a lot for the actors, ourselves, not to break on stage, because we're finding lots of funny moments to treasure every night.
Lily Tung Crystal, director of this production, tell us a little bit about the theater. I'm not familiar with the theater at Potrero Stage on 18th Street.
Yes, it's a wonderful little space. A lot of new work happens there. There's actually a lot of new work being developed in San Francisco. And so Potrero Stage is run by Playground, which is a New Works theater. Also, two other wonderful New Works theaters are in residency there, Golden Thread and Crowded Fire.
Ah, yes. Okay, I have seen something at Crowded
Fire. Yes, and it's a beautiful 100-seat, like 99-seat house, and they just renovated it, and It's got a lot of height, so you know our story is set in the Hamptons. So we have sort of this grand Hampton's house in a small theater, but it has the feeling of grandness because of the height of the theater. And, all the trappings of, I guess, for lack of a better word, whiteness in the Hamptons. We sort of, hit hard on those things. And, what Leah does, the playwright does in this play is that her inspiration for the play was that one specific New York company, one season, she and her playwright friends noticed that they were doing a whole season of what she calls White People by the Water plays, where a white family goes into a big house by the water and talks about their problems, a la August Osage County or The Seagull, Grey Gardens. And she said, why is this narrative so prevalent in the American canon? And so she set out to write a play that basically sums up all the tropes in the American canon. And so in our play, there's a sentiment of nearly every trope in that we would expect in sort of the family living room drama that we often see in American theater. And at the time, she also noticed that there was quite a few casting controversies in theater and film in terms of Caucasian actors playing roles that were, or characters that have historically been Asian or Asian American. And so she thought that to even bend it a little bit more, how appropriate would it be to have Asian American actors or actors of color play the white family? Because so much of our stories are often appropriated by Caucasian theater makers. So she takes like two very prevalent lines and trends in American theater and completely turns them on their head.
Interesting. We should mention that Leah was one that coveted a Jerome Fellowship at the LARC, which is designed to support an early career writer of extraordinary ability and promise from a pool of some 286 applicants, and also recently received this year's Yale Drama Series Prize, quite a coveted prize there. And she's going to be in attendance on Saturday evening for a talk back after the show.
Yes, she's going to be there. She's going to do a fireside chat after the show on Saturday, June 30th. So come on down, everybody. And there's still tickets available. Leah is not only a brilliant writer, but she is a really warm, generous, funny person. So you'll love meeting her.
Mm-hmm. The cast not only includes my guest, Rinda Beth Apostol, Greg Ayers, Sean Fenton, Karen Offerins, and Michelle Talgaro are also in the cast. I thank you for coming in, Rinda Beth. We wish you a great run there.
Thank you very much.
And may we look forward to what's happening in this production as well as future productions down the road for Ferocious Lotus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for coming in. Information about the show, which runs through July 15th, is at ferociouslotus.org, and the Potrero stage is at 1695 18th Street. Ferocious Lotus presents the world premiere of 2 Mile Hollow by Leah Nanako Winkler. Joining me now in studio for a summer arts update is our regular contributor, Peter Robinson. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Yeah, good to be here. And there really are two great summer exhibitions going on in the city for art buffs, and they're at major art museums. And the first I'm going to talk about is based on the paintings of René Magritte. The collection is at the Museum of Modern Art, and it runs through the summer into mid-October. This, to me, is really an outstanding collection with over 77 exhibits, and 20 of these have not been seen before on public display. And one tip I give if you're going to the Magritte exhibition is consider going with a friend, because I was with the Chair of Art History from Davis and also the Assistant Curator, and we would each look at these different paintings and have three very different takes. So how you actually interpret the art, which is really what Magritte wanted viewers to do, makes for a lively conversation, possible disagreement, but certainly provocative. Now, I said there were 77 in total exhibits, but the actual rooms break down into 8 different rooms. And as you enter the exhibition, you're looking at work from around about 1947, 1948. It's the post-war period, and during the war, René Magritte was, who's Belgian, he lived in Brussels. So he really had a reaction to the Nazi occupation. And that very first room is a kind of angry room. You feel his discontent, and you feel that he definitely put away his creative juices and just let his emotions flow. So you gradually move into some of the classic pieces. We probably know him today as the man in the bowler hat. And there's a whole room given over to these very interesting images. In French, it's known as the Chapeau Melon. And often the face is blocked out or it's white. So there's a kind of anonymous sense to what his painting is about. And again, he's looking through a window. There's a sense of flatness. And certainly when it comes to depth of perception, I think the man in the bowler hat is really symbolic. Some people see it as a self-portrait, although the Son of Man, which is one of the pictures on display, is most seen as that, as an example. So then you move into my favorite room, which was called the Dominion of Light. And here are 17 oil paintings, and each of them, in different ways, are looking at the influence of how lighting and twilight and dark scenes really became the theme. And one thing I learned, which I didn't know at the time, is that Magritte was heavily influenced by Dashiell Hammett, and there is a kind of eerie quality in some of the paintings. I was trying to find the body. Who did it? How did it happen?
I didn't realize that.
No, it was news to me, and I think that's the great advantage of going with a friend and speaking about what you know, what they know, and then what you see. And so the great thing about the Magritte exhibition is that all his work, for different reasons, draw you in.
And not only the large ones, I was at the exhibit a couple of weeks ago, but not only the large, I'm fascinated by the detail that he can get in just his, some of his very small miniatures. It's really quite incredible.
Yeah, it's a contrast. And that large one that you're referring to was actually done as a mural in a casino in Brussels, and they've broken it down into different segments. So, again, you're just seeing an artist who I think pushed the imagination to the hilt, asked you to question the nature of photography, asked you to question the nature of painting, and when I use the word surrealism, he to me really goes beyond that, because you're totally engaged and involved in the painting. So this is a great day out. If you have a friend visiting and they want to see one of the great museums here in the city, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, not just for the Magritte, but also for the other stuff going on.
Beautiful new wing that they added recently to it.
They have indeed, stunning. Yeah. And I wandered into the gift shop, and I suddenly saw a pair of silk pajamas, men's silk pajamas with Magritte images, and they just cost, as they expected, $375. So if you want to give a gift to a friend, buy the pajamas, and then, of course,
a very good friend.
There's endless bowler hats, huh. So you can go to bed with a bowler hat and a pair of Magritte pajamas.
And I should also mention that the exhibit ends with this wonderful interactive room where you can actually insert yourself into some of Magritte's paintings through the use of some video projection in real time. So it's not just for the kids as well. You can really have a lot of fun at this Magritte exhibit.
And in that end room, which is well worth spending a few minutes in, you can take a photograph. So you can actually be in a Magritte painting.
Exactly. I love it. sfmoma.org for more information about their exhibit times.
Now, my second suggestion for summer art buffs is to wander up to the De Young Museum. It's actually a beautiful ground. You can walk around it there. And what they have going is weapons of mass seduction. I'm going to emphasize the word seduction, because this is a exhibition of propaganda and how propaganda has been used since the time of the First World War up through the 1940s to stir up nationalism, stir up patriotism. And I found myself constantly asking, those were the days when pictures and word spoke. You know, today we live in the world of tweets, and I could see a connection in my own head between honesty and dishonesty in some of the tweets I get, particularly presidential ones, where I'm wondering, is this propaganda, or am I just imagining it's true? So in the Wars of Words, which is the subtitle for this, you can see some of the famous ones, Your Country Needs You, the finger of Uncle Sam pointing at you. And then the British wartime one, Keep Calm and Carry On. So you're seeing a combination of images and words, but also they have movies. 90% of Disney's wartime production was done for training films, top secret training films, but also images. And they are extended the exhibition beyond this country. And I never knew this till I went there. During the war, Vichy France, which was the France favouring the German occupation, actually ran a Disney movie where Mickey Mouse is flying an American bomber, actually bombing the French.
Lovely.
So you turn things around, and of course no better propagandist than Joseph Goebbels, who was Hitler's minister of propaganda.
And sorry, Mr. Goebbels.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right. Yeah. You remember him. There we go. I didn't know this either. Today we have T-shirts, but during the war in Japan, you could get kimonos with wartime messages on them. So here are two very different contrasting exhibitions. There are 77 different posters, plus films, movies, wartime images, and that is at the De Young Museum. And it will make you think about how images and works and images and words come together to put across a message. And whether you agree or don't agree with the message, it's definitely a form of advertising, a different form of nationalism or patriotism.
The De Young's website is deyoung.famsf.org.
So we have two exhibits, one down there, which is the Magritte, which is running at the Museum of Modern Art, and then up on the park. Have a walk around the park while you're there at the De Young Museum for a very provocative and questioning set of art exhibits. Is it art? Is it propaganda? Or is it something else?
Take a friend, take your bowler hat, and perhaps buy some pajamas. Thanks, Peter.
You got that right.
We'll see you soon. Peter will be guest host for the next 2 weeks of Open Air. We thank him for his extracurricular activities and his extra hosting duties. I'm going to take a couple weeks off for that. Just a couple more opportunities, speaking of things to do this weekend. Two more opportunities tonight at 8 and Saturday evening at 8 to catch the wonderful Mahler Third Symphony conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas with the San Francisco Symphony. Sasha Cook is the guest mezzo-soprano soloist. You'll also hear the Pacific Boy Choir and the women of the San Francisco Symphony Chorus as prepared by Ragnar Bolin. Mahler's Third, an incredible work. We're just going to hear a little touch of that as we say goodbye to this edition of Open Air. sfsymphony.org for more information for that. some 200 musicians on the stage for Mahler's Third Symphony, a very brief excerpt of that first movement to entice you for the Michael Tilson Thomas conducting of Mahler's Third Symphony with the San Francisco Symphony tomorrow night and Saturday night at 8 with Sasha Cook, as well as the Pacific Boy Choir and the women of the San Francisco Symphony, really celebrating this amazing work that expresses the composer's vision of life, death, and redemption. sfsymphony.org for more information. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW. Neil Swinkels produces the show. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. If you've got an organization or artistic guest that you think would make a nice guest here on the show, by all means, let me know. David@kalw.org. This is our showcase for the performing arts here in the Bay Area, and we appreciate your feedback and suggestions. As I mentioned, Peter Robinson will be guest host these next couple of weeks, and I'll see you in August.